continuing to look into Dogen Zenji's teaching on mind itself is Buddha, Sokushin Zei Butsu. And to review a bit, Dogen is starting this teaching with bringing up various misinterpretations of what mind as Buddha means. At the beginning, he says, upon hearing the phrase, mind itself is Buddha, ignorant people think that the thoughts and, discriminating thoughts and awareness of ordinary beings who have not yet aroused the enlightenment-seeking mind are already Buddhas. That discriminating thoughts is Buddha. Discriminating thoughts for those who have not aroused bodhicitta, this wish to be free from all entrapments of the false view of an independent self. And then Dogen goes on to bring up this view of Seneca or Shrenika, Shrenika Vatsagotra, in Pali called Vachagota, so maybe today I'll just start by reading this theory of Seneca or Shrenika, who lived in India outside the way, a wanderer practitioner in India who whose view was at first not in accord with the Buddha's teaching. This was his theory. The great road, or great way, the Tao, lies within this body right now. How it works is easy to know. The soul discerns pain and pleasure, cold and heat, aching and itching. And soul, that's being translated as soul here, and down later in this paragraph, in this section, called knowing spirit, is the Chinese characters basically mean like spiritual knowing, like a spirit, a spiritual knowing, or sometimes translated as soul. Particularly having to do with deceased people, the soul of deceased people. So, not usually used as a Buddhist term. Spirit or soul or a mysterious awareness, and combined with the character for knowing or perceiving. So it's like spiritual knowing. One translation says spiritual intelligence, a knowing soul, some kind of deep, eternal, mysterious awareness, something like that. So here's, at this point, it's being translated as soul. And the soul, this kind of inner self, discerns pain and pleasure, cold and heat, aching and itching. There's some awareness that knows these obvious things happening to the body. It's not obstructed by things, and it's not concerned with objects. While things come and go, and objects are born and perish, the soul exists without changing. It pervades all sentient beings, both ordinary and sacred. Although there are flowers of emptiness, which are false reality, sky flowers is another translation, which is like illusory appearances. It's a Chinese way of saying illusory appearances, flowers of emptiness, which are false reality. As soon as an embracing wisdom appears, even for a moment, things disappear and objects perish. The soul, the original nature, alone is clearly permanent. When the body is broken, the soul comes out of it unbroken. It's just like the owner of a house on fire who comes out of it safely. So the body is like the house on fire. It's burning up at the end of life, but the owner can run out and go dwell in a new house until it burns down, is the metaphor here. What is luminous is called the nature of an awakened or wise person, a Buddha. This is awakening. Self and other equally possess this nature. Both enlightenment and delusion are connected with it. Whatever things or objects may be, the soul is different from them and unchanged for eons. The objects that exist right now are real only if the soul abides in them. As these objects arise from the soul, the original nature, they are true reality. But they're not permanent. They exist and then disappear. As the soul intuitively knows bright and dark, it is called a knowing spirit. It's also called the true self, the source of awakening, true nature, or true body. To realize such a true nature is described as returning to permanence. This soul is called a great being that returns to reality. After such realization, the soul does not transmigrate in birth and death. Beforehand, it would transmigrate through birth and death and be reborn again and again, the soul. It enters the ocean of true nature of no birth and death after realization. There is no reality other than this. When this true nature is not revealed, the three realms and the six paths emerge one after the other. The three realms of, in Buddhist cosmology, the desire realm, the form realm, and the formless realm, different subtleties of samsara. They're all the three realms are within samsara, and the six paths are the six realms, six worlds of heavenly beings, humans, and the fighting spirits, and then the hungry ghosts, and the hell beings, and animals are the six worlds. So three realms and six worlds are like all of samsara. So the soul keeps transmigrating through these realms of samsara until realization. So that's the view of Seneca. And there's parts of it that sound quite wonderful teaching. And so, depending on how you looked at Buddha Dharma in the past, this might sound, this sounds like how I think of practice and how my kind of view of how life and soul and birth and death would work. But Dogen is saying that this view does not accord with reality. And I think he's bringing this up in the context of this essay because we're clarifying that mind itself is Buddha. So even though he doesn't say this explicitly, it seems to be pointing out this way of understanding that this soul or spiritual intelligence is what some people think of as mind, and that that is Buddha. Yes.
I just took a breath, but maybe that's a question. Well, it is really interesting how the similarities.
Yeah.
You know, and so one of the things I'm noticing is that this Seneca's view is that the realization of this true nature, much of which sounds very similar to what we talk about, what Dogen talks about, but he says here, it's described as returning to permanence.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if that might be one of the pivotal differences.
Mm-hmm. I think that's... Mm-hmm.
That, you know, a lot of us would say, yeah, that's all true, and it falls away, rather than it maintains itself.
I think permanence is a key thing here, yeah. And the separation of mind and body is another thing that's being brought out, that this is...
Right.
It's within the soul is within the body, and it discerns these bodily, you know, sensations like cold and heat and pain and pleasure, but it's not attached to them. And while those things come and go, it remains as permanent.
So the separation of mind and body is another thing. Yeah. Dogen is saying that's not our understanding, mm-hmm. because mind is body.
Yeah, or they're interdependent,
yeah.
and not separable. And it's a little tricky, this point about permanence, because in Mahayana Buddhism, when we talk about Buddha nature, even in the classical texts of Buddha nature, it sounds like it's something permanent. And even in the early teachings, like nirvana is considered permanent. And ultimate truth is considered permanent, in a sense. The in the Yogacara school, the mind-only teachings, there's this term for suchness, equated with suchness and emptiness, but in this particular school it's put positively, and it's called the thoroughly established nature of all phenomena, and it abides in permanent, everlasting time. And it's referring to actually emptiness, it's not something. And same with Buddha nature, which is the tricky part, and maybe not so hard to see how emptiness, which is the absence of any ungraspability, of any graspability, everything is empty of any fixed nature, that emptiness of fixed nature doesn't change. Right? The fact that things have no fixed nature, that fact never changes. Right? It's maybe kind of obvious in a way. And so, therefore we call it permanent. The way things are empty is permanent. But emptiness is not a thing, and nirvana is not a thing, and cessation is not a thing. So that's how we can get away with calling it permanent. It's the absence of thingness, actually. Yeah.
So I would like it if you would repeat the three realms really fast.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a little detail in there, you know, that's not, he's not really going to get into, but just part of Buddhist cosmology, you know, is you often hear about the three realms and the six paths. So three realms are the desire realm, the kama dhatu. Dhatu is like a realm, and that's the world that we basically live in, that all sentient beings live in all the time. All six paths, you could say, are mostly living in this, the desire realm. And you know, kama, like the Kama Sutra, means like lust or desire, and because that's like the dominant characteristic of the realm that we usually live in, it's like we're greatly influenced by desire, sense desire, and interestingly, that's the name for the world that most people live in continuously, and the other two realms are just entered by deep meditation practice. So without some kind of intentional meditation practice, beings don't ever even imagine such a thing as a form realm and a formless realm. So the form realm, they're sometimes called like meditational heavens. So in the Buddhist cosmology, it's an interesting thing of they're like meditation states, but they're also in this cosmology of heaven. Heaven and hell realms are all brought forth in Buddha's teaching. Particularly Abhidharma gets really into the setup of how all this works, and so they're like Deva realms. So I take back when I say everyone in the six realms is in the desire realm, because the devas are ones who dwell in these higher realms. Devas sometimes translated as gods, but they're impermanent, godlike spirit beings. One, the highest, pinnacle of the six realms, six worlds. And the devas become devas through meditation practice, but not necessarily insight practice. The way it's usually talked about in Buddha's teaching is through concentration practice. So these all, before Buddha's teaching, the insight into emptiness and so on, before that even appeared in this world, there were devas living in these form and formless realms. And the form realm is like, one way it's sometimes talked about is like, there aren't like a bunch of conceptual things going on. There's just form. So there's like, it would be like, and the meditational kind of experience of this would be like, you know, I look down here and instead of seeing a book, I just see this brown color. That's just like, you know, visual form. And, but no conceptuality, just direct perception of form. So maybe we could call it the realm of direct perception. So there's where, you know, there's very little suffering, because most of our suffering comes from conceptuality, actually, from our conceptual mind, making up stories about things and grasping them. And if we're just in this form realm, it is still within samsara, the realm of suffering, but the suffering or discontent would be very attenuated, barely, we wouldn't feel like normal sense of discontent. But it's impermanent, like all of samsara, so it's just a meditational kind of trance. And even if the devas are living in this realm for eons or something like that, it's still impermanent. And the formless realm is just when there's actually form skanda, in terms of the five skandhas, form skanda is no longer even there. So it's an even subtler meditation realm where it's just like subtle mind stuff, no physicality there at all. So this is Buddhist cosmology. You know, are there really devas, beings existing in these realms? Or is it all just metaphor for possibilities of practice and cultivation? Yeah.
Sorry, Kokyo, but I'm curious about how Seneca, mm-hmm. how does he teach that these, it says, I can't find it. The part about the soul, it only exists, something, an object that exists right now are real only if the soul abides in them. So is he saying that all objects have a soul that abides in them impermanently, and then the soul leaves and the object is no longer real? Or is he saying that beings with a soul, such as sentient beings, somehow give that to objects with their attention?
Or almost like creates them. It sounds like that these objects arise from the soul. You know, they only exist right now if the soul abides in them.
Meaning the soul is aware of them or conscious of them.
Yeah, but then it says, as these objects arise from the soul, the original nature of their true reality. So it's not so clear what he's saying, you know, actually. It's kind of like... It's kind of like, you know, to try to explain, like, well, he mean, you know, this is how that would work. We maybe can't do because it's not going to work. It's a strange idea.
I was wondering how he ended it.
Yeah, we don't know exactly, but okay. Yes.
Thank you.
That's why Duncan says it's a false
view. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Well, but we say things arise from mind, right?
The whole explanation that Duncan's going for here is that the whole piece he's missing here is impermanence. Right?
Could say impermanence and emptiness or ungraspability or no independent self.
Because this Seneca mm-hmm. in India, mm-hmm. I'm not sure what time.
The Buddhist time.
In the Buddhist mm-hmm. time. Because this seems like there's a lot of, you know, the Atman going on.
Exactly.
So it's a different school.
Yeah.
So you see them crossing over.
Yeah. There's a lot of similarity, and that's why, and in Zen, you hear a lot of these types of teachings, and this next, you know, the next paragraph is going to get into a Zen person putting forth this view, and like, is this right? And the teacher's going to say, no, that's actually the view of Seneca too. So it gets quite subtle, but that's why we can go over more the difference between these two views. But it's basically, I think the main points are going to be about permanence and impermanence and some kind of fixed nature and independent self and these types of things. And I think this is, you know, this can get kind of detailed, these discussions, but I think the root of them is the most essential matter, I think, in our whole practice, really. Like, this is the, as when we were discussing Nagarjuna's teachings, you know, any kind of grasping is basically the source of suffering, or is suffering, grasping anything as fixed reality. So if we understand that as the underlying basis of practice, that to understand how to let go of whatever we're holding on to, all Buddha's teachings, we could say, are pointing back to this, to make it really basic. Now, and then we're just going to get into all these detailed ways and subtle ways that we grasp things, hold on to, you know, conceptually hold on to various things, and therefore are not completely free and content with whatever's happening. So that's maybe the larger context of this whole study. And then we can get into all the subtleties. And in something like Sesshin, where we're sitting a lot, our mind can get pretty subtle. Like, we can feel pretty settled, maybe sometimes, and yet still feel like something's a little off here. And particularly these views of something like, there's something in my soul isn't content, maybe we might feel. And then so to deeply investigate all of what that might mean in our own experience through these teachings is part of the function of this. Yes.
And I think it's also important, I'm recalling that all of these kind of counter, these teachings that Dogen's putting out saying it's not that,
mm-hmm.
is in service of helping us understand that the mind itself is Buddha.
Yes.
So it's like maybe common ways that we misunderstand that.
Exactly.
Just for showing us a bunch of these common ways that we misunderstand it. And I haven't, because I've been leading and because I'm Tenzo, I haven't really like read the whole thing.
Yeah.
I presume he's going to get to this punchline of, and then this is what I mean. Maybe he won't. But
a little bit.
Maybe
he doesn't as much as we might expect.
And just go no. But even if he just goes no, that's one of our ways we learn things.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Yeah.
Neither this nor that. he puts forth some teaching at the end, and it's not as if you want to really get a hold of something, that mind being Buddha. Please don't have any expectations.
Okay.
So.
I thought maybe you were saying that after I left.
Yeah. It's like the
Lotus Sutra. Okay, the Lotus
Sutra,
the whole thing, but now.
Mm-hmm. So I think we're to look at self, and maybe just also to bring up a little bit about Atman, as you mentioned. So, as you probably know, the teaching of Anatman is one of the three marks of all conditioned phenomena. One of Buddha's main teachings. All conditioned things are Anatman, no self, no fixed independent self, impermanent, and marked by dissatisfaction or discontent, suffering. Anatman, dukkha is discontent, and impermanence, anicca, anatman, anicca, and dukkha, these three characteristics of all conditioned things. And and the no independent self is a really key thing, and expanded in the Mahayana, like Nagarjuna talking about no self nature of anything, not just a person. But Atman, just a little bit about Atman, I think we hardly ever hear of it from the schools where it derived from. We hear like the Buddhist take on Atman. So this is just, this is maybe not the most scholarly source, this is just from Wikipedia. But it's not a Buddhist site, it's a, like a Vedanta or Hindu-oriented site talking about Atman. And so this sounds, you know, they're putting it in a positive sense how this could hold up. And just, you know, briefly, Atman is a philosophical term used within Hinduism and Vedanta to identify the soul. It's one's true self. So usually in English translated as self, like with a capital S sometimes. Beyond identification with the phenomenal reality of worldly existence. So as I said yesterday, I think it's a little different from ego self. And there's Hindu terms that are like different words that are used for like ego self. This is like true self. And you could say maybe the Buddhist view on Atman would be, we're not so much refuting the ego self, we're refuting a view of a true independent self beyond the ego. But that Buddhism would say that view of a true self is the cause for the manifestations of what we might call ego self. Manifestations of like selfishness and, you know, petty self-centered thinking come from the view of that there's some, that there's really somebody here. Whereas this Vedanta view would be more like, they don't come from that actually. It's that we're out of touch with Atman. We're out of touch with our true self, and that's why we get into petty self-concern, narrow little self-concern. And the goal is more like to open to this Atman, actually. And you know, people make arguments now in America where all these schools are interacting together and being practiced, and people are even combining them. You know, I think of Adyashanti, for example, who I'm a big fan of, has some background or practice in Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta, non-dual Vedanta, and Zen. And so his way of talking about practice and enlightenment, he uses kind of both these sides. He talks about, you know, his true awareness, you know, permanent awareness that doesn't come and go and things like this. So we can see, you know, how what we think about this idea of an Atman. It's so there's within Vedanta, which is, I don't know if it's exactly the same as what we call Hinduism. I think Hinduism is a English word that is maybe coined kind of recently, but based on the teachings of Vedanta and pre-Buddhist teachings, Vedanta's teachings of the Vedas that go back to like 5000 BC, like way, way before Buddha. So then there's Advaita Vedanta, which literally means non-dual, Advaita means non-dual, and then there's Dvaita. Dvaita and Advaita. So Dvaita is dual, dualistic view of Vedanta. And this is these two schools of Vedanta. So Advaita Vedanta, which is, you know, most of what we know of is like Ramana Maharshi and these really amazing teachers that sound very much like Zen teachings and so on. So Advaita Vedanta schools see the soul with the Atman within each living entity as being fully identical with Brahman, the all-pervading soul of the universe. And so the goal of the practice is to kind of unite the individual soul with the universal soul, unite Atman and Brahman. But Dvaita schools of Vedanta differentiate between the individual Atman in living beings and the supreme Atman, para Paramatma as being at least partially separate. Like, you know, the universal soul is like, we, you know, it's too much to say we're going to individually unite with that somehow. At least partially, we can't completely be identical to it, merge with it completely, according to this dualistic school. So the Atman thus can be used to describe an individual soul or the impersonal supreme, depending on the speaker's philosophical point of view. I think this is interesting to hear. That's a view of Atman that I think as I hear that, even though it sounds pretty good, I think some of the you know, especially later philosophical schools of Buddhism like Nagarjuna would be, and I think early Buddhist teaching as well, would be refuting any kind of view of that there's some universal universal soul or something like that. Unless what we're calling a universal soul or God, for example, if we're calling that, like I have sometimes mentioned before, like the interdependent arising of the whole universe is the soul of the universe. If we say it like that, then okay. But if there's something more real and graspable in a very subtle way or permanent entity called the soul of the universe, that's what's going to be somewhat problematic just because it leaves something to grasp. That's the basic problem. And I could say, well, what's so bad about grasping the soul of the universe? Maybe not so bad, but in terms of subtleties of being completely free from any place to stand, I think it's very radical about the Buddhist teachings. It's taking away any place to stand on anything, any security in anything, which is why it's so, the further we go into it, the more challenging it seems to be. It's like, really let go of any idea about anything? And yet, that is, the irony is that's the supreme security, when there's nothing to hold on to, no ground to stand on at all, just, but yet, here we are alive. It's the supreme security because nothing can do anything about such a non-abiding nature. Yes?
Where does taking refuge fit in with that, with this aspect?
Taking refuge in Buddha?
The Triple Treasure.
Yeah. The Buddha in one of the early teachings said, when one sees the Dharma, one sees me, the Buddha. When one sees the Buddha, one sees the Dharma. And then he elsewhere said, the Dharma is dependent co-arising. So, and Sangha, you know, maybe we could tack on also, but particularly to take refuge in Buddha and Dharma would be to take refuge in dependent co-arising, means like that no independence, just that everything is interdependently arising and ceasing, and there's no underlying essence of anything other than that. And to take refuge in means take refuge in that understanding.
It's funny because, I mean, it's the same thing as what you just said, that there's a quality to the term taking refuge that always feels kind of comforting. To me, like when I really need
it is.
Comfort,
yeah.
You know, either I'll like go to Avalokiteshvara, really, you know, primitive and devotional, or I'll comfort myself with this, you know, taking refuge.
Well, if that's what we're taking refuge in, dependent co-arising, and you know, with the deep understanding of what that means, it means that there's nothing substantial. Dependent co-arising means that there's nothing substantial anywhere, and there's no substantial self or other, and so on, is an implication of dependent co-arising. So, or we could even say taking refuge in emptiness is taking refuge in Buddha and Dharma and Sangha. If we see it in that way, it might not feel so comforting as like, I take refuge in Buddha, this great person who lived in India at that time, because that's a little more graspable than Buddha, that's like, ungraspable. But again, I would say it is the supreme comfort and security if we really understand, the implications of refuge in complete ungraspability of everything. At first, it doesn't seem that way. To our little self, it doesn't seem that that would be very secure. In fact, it's the greatest threat in the world. What was the phrase you used?
Ontological terror.
Ontological terror. Yes. It's the supreme ontological terror to the false view of self, the little imagined self that its main duty is to protect itself at all costs, protect its identity in a way, protect itself from being refuted as a false view. it's this little mirage kind of person that's like, don't refute me, I'm not a mirage, come on, I'm real. And so to that one, there's ontological terror starts to arise when we approach such dharma. But going through the gate, at the other side of the gate, then it's the supreme security and ease, because we no longer have to do anything particular. It's like free right in the midst of like this five skandhas like thing with like arms and legs flailing about and I don't know what to do, but like, oh, totally, it's okay. Like, I sometimes think of approaching the gate, if we call it a gate or something like that, the approach is more and more like difficult, like the wind or something is getting stronger and stronger as we get closer and closer, like, no, not through, and then we just like step through and suddenly it's like, it's total like ease, and like we look back at the gate and like, wow, why was I resisting such a gate? It's, how nice it is on this side. And that could sound like a big grand thing, stepping through the big giant grand gate, but I think just in a small way, just in zazen, I think we have these little gates that we go through of like, for example, resisting, why do I have to sit through this whole period, when's the bell gonna ring? And then we just remember, for example, like, oh yeah, just, it's not, this is not how I think it is, really, or even just let go, and just, and suddenly, like, we're the same period, the bell still hasn't rung, and now we're the other side of the gate, and we look back and like, who was that one who was like silently screaming just a second ago? So, a little bit aman, and I think also as these views get into, Seneca just said, it's objects are born and perish, but the soul exists without changing. And it's also implying that it's going on from life to life. I think this usually whenever we get into an Atman kind of view, eternal soul, it's going to bring up this issue of rebirth. And so we talked a little bit about it yesterday, but I think maybe this is important too for those who are clarifying the view of Buddha's Dharma to have some sense of how this rebirth issue can work, because people will ask us about it. We hear them, like especially the Tibetans, right? They're always talking about rebirth, and the question that always comes up is, well, if there's no eternal soul or Atman, then what's reborn? What keeps going from life to life? So I think one of the greatest sources for this, and it's related to this whole Seneca controversy, is, although it's not Seneca himself, this is another early teaching from the Middle-Length Discourses, number 38. And the Blessed One, the Buddha, was living at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove, and on that occasion, a pernicious view had arisen in a monk named Sati, son of a fisherman. Thus, Sati's view, has arisen, and he's a Buddhist monk. So he, as I understand the Dharma taught by the Buddha, it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the round of rebirths, not another. Or, you know, it's not another consciousness in the next life. It's this consciousness. So five skandhas. It's obviously form skandhas, not reborn. The body is not. And even feelings and perceptions and karmic formations, he doesn't bring those up. He says, it looks like if we say something's reborn, I understand the Buddha to say that it's the fifth skanda, consciousness. Skanda is what runs and wanders through the rounds of rebirth. So he's using the word consciousness, vijnana, but he's maybe interpreting consciousness as something like an Atman or an eternal soul. But this would, he might be feeling, well, this accords with the Buddha's teaching. We don't have to bring in Atman, just consciousness. But consciousness, in this case, is a permanent thing that's going from life to life. And several other monks, having heard about this, went to this monk Sati and asked him, "Friend Sati, is it true that such a pernicious view has arisen in you?" They don't just say view, such a pernicious view. And he agrees and says, "Exactly so, friends. As I understand the Dharma, it is this consciousness that runs and wanders through the rounds of rebirth." Then those monks, desiring to detach him from that pernicious view, pressed and questioned and cross-questioned him thus, "Friend Sati, do not say so. Do not misrepresent the Blessed One. It's not good to misrepresent the Blessed One. The Blessed One would not speak thus. For in many discourses, the Blessed One has stated consciousness to be dependently arisen, since without a condition, there is no origination of consciousness." So if consciousness, the fifth skanda, like all the other skandhas, is dependently arisen, depends on other conditions, and it arises and ceases, then it's not the same consciousness continuing through. Dependent co-arising implies impermanence. But then what's reborn? And so basically, they drag him to the Buddha. and and the same dialogue happens. The Buddha says, "Do I understand you to have this view?" And he says, "Yes, I have this view. I understand your teaching to be this way." And then the Buddha asks, "What is that consciousness, Sati, that you're speaking of?" And he says, "Venerable Sir, it's that which speaks and feels and experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions." And that sounds a lot like Seneca's view. I think he maybe even says almost the exact same thing. It's like that which it experiences pain and pleasure and itches and so on. But in this case, the one that receives the fruits of karma. And therefore, he ties in karma to rebirth quite nicely in his pernicious view. Because, you know, this consciousness receives the results of good and bad actions, and that's what the Buddha's teaching did teach. Buddha did teach rebirth, or maybe to be more accurate, he taught birth. There's no actually Pali word that's rebirth. He taught birth. And because rebirth implies that there's something being reborn again and again. So I think that distinction is maybe important. It's not, we say rebirth, and maybe conventionally it's okay to say, but it's not like there's something that's born again. It's like there's birth dependent on the previous birth, and consciousness in a new birth dependent on the previous consciousness moment. And karmic formations, the fourth skanda, karmic formations, is the results of karma or actions. And again, so it's not karmic formations stream being reborn, but dependent on the previous karmic formations ceasing, a new karmic formations skanda, you know, skandhas aren't some actual thing, but it's a way of talking. But there's a karmic effects, maybe we could say, a stream of karmic causality arising and ceasing, dependently arising and dependently ceasing, is dependently arises in a new birth. So, which is why we could say, you know, some explanation to why people seem to be different even at birth. There's some karmic inheritance, but not from another, not from a past like soul, or from the past consciousness that experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions. This is kind of hard to get this point that it's not some thing, and yet it's not that there's no connection at all. And I think maybe when this has come up before, I brought up this metaphor as metaphors go, you know, I think it's pretty good, but it's just a metaphor, so it's maybe it has flaws. But we could also see this as a way of thinking about Buddha's version of birth and death, like candles. So this image of like there's a candle, we could say it's the form skanda candle. You can see it. It's a physical thing, and it has it's lit as a flame that's like a call it the consciousness skanda. And maybe in this metaphor, let's skip the other three skandhas, because just to simplify. So something like the body, and then the body and mind is the candle and the flame. And the flame is, you know, it's limited because it's also, well, it's not exactly a physical thing, but it's like light, and it's not, what is it? You know, it's, you can't actually grasp a flame, and yet it has function, and it is light, and it creates light, and it, you know, it's a metaphor for consciousness in this case. And so this candle's getting lower and lower and lower as the body melts away. And just when the candle's about to go out, we take a new fresh candle and light it, you know, in the metaphor of maybe tiny baby candle that would grow, but they don't work that way. So say we take a new candle, but it's like a new body, and light this candle from the old candle. That one, the flame just goes out when the wax is gone, when the body, the physical body, no longer supports that flame, no longer supports that consciousness. It goes out, and now there's this flame on this new candle, and it has its life till it burns down. And the metaphor is, you know, quite nice in many ways, because it's like the body and mind are interdependent. You can't have the flame without the candle. You could have a body that it would be like, if you just suddenly blew out the flame, it would be like a dead body. But they kind of, they're interdependent too. They go together. They function together. And now if you look at this flame, is it the same, you know, is it the same flame as from on the other candle, or is it a different one? And the way the fire works is like, it's not exactly the same flame, because this flame was like dependent on this candle, but it's definitely dependent on the previous flame. And, you know, the metaphor starts to break down about how karma would connect there. But it's not exactly the same, and it's not completely unrelated, obviously, either, because it was lit from this other one. But this one ceased, and this one arose. And now this one's on this body candle. Does that make some sense? See, I think that works to say that it doesn't have to be this continuous thing through, but it's dependency. It's dependent co-arising. There's a dependent relationship between one life and the former life. Now, the whole issue of rebirth is a big topic, and you know, there's debate in particularly, I think, American Buddhism about, do we even need this rebirth thing? Isn't this just like, Buddha just took it up because it was totally the cultural norm in India in his time, and it would be too much to just throw out the whole thing, so he tried to integrate it into his teaching of dependent co-arising in this way. Some people say that, and we don't even need this now. Some people say, no, it's completely, if you have dependent co-arising, then you have to have rebirth. It's like, it's an implication of the Buddha's most basic teaching. And the whole path of practice, some people would say, requires this view that until there's no more karma created, then there's going to be birth. And so it's not just this life. We're not just practicing for this life. We're evolving life to life. And it's incentive for wholehearted practice. Some people say, I don't need that incentive. I'm just practicing for this life to be happy and free here and now. We don't, you know, we don't want to get into this future life thing. That would be like, you know, forget about this life. It's all about the eternal future after death. So, big debates maybe. And maybe we don't want to get into this sidetrack. But maybe the important thing is just is this issue of that there's no, it's not a, we don't need a soul or an Atman to have a teaching of rebirth. It seems like it does fit in with the Buddha's teaching of dependent co-arising. But, yeah.
Just mention one thing about the candle.
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting example or metaphor. And one of the things I read in a, from a Rinzai master is that the candle, actually the flame on the candle is not one flame. And that in actuality, as the wick burns, and this is physically true of candles, I've learned, that as the wick burns, if the candle flame actually goes out and relights on every, you can't see it, it happens so fast. So it's actually a new flame all the way down.
Yeah, I mean, that would be, that's exactly, and that I think is important to know, to this view that everything's impermanent, so it's not a permanent flame, although it might even look like it's still
so permanent. All you're carrying forward is the last flame.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that we can't, conditions.
Yeah.
Different from the condition of the new flame when you first lit that candle.
Yeah, it's a different flame. And it looks so similar that we think it looks permanent, at least for a little bit, but it actually doesn't even last more than a tiny moment, just like this body seems permanent, and then at the end of its life, it suddenly becomes impermanent and changes, but actually, there's birth and death every moment. Yes?
Well, I don't know how much you want to go on, because it's very interesting. But, you know, another metaphor for karma is, you know, there's one billiard ball against another billiard ball. And so
that's good, know, yeah.
What's bumping up against something else that's you know, causing, you know, this flame to now be in this other body, which, you know, in lots of Buddhist stories, they don't even have to be close to each other.
Yeah. Almost like in the billiard ball, it's like energy. Almost like it's like this ball hits this one, this one goes, and it's definitely not about, the balls are definitely different, but the energy is transferred from one to another, you know, kinetic energy or whatever it is. And so again, all the metaphors in the end kind of break down, but that's even, that one points out the side of that it's not even any, like the flame is something almost physical, but with between balls bouncing, it's completely not physical. And it's not, it's, and the energy between balls hitting each other is like completely ungraspable, actually. That way that that energy, you know, maybe a physicist could actually describe how momentum works and stuff, but it's, I think that metaphor is, in some ways, I think, nicer because it's even less graspable how that transformation happens. Later in this sutra about Sati the fisherman's son. The Buddha gets into the conditionality of consciousness, and he gets into this, the fire metaphor. I didn't even think of this, but when consciousness arises dependent on the eye and form, it's reckoned as eye consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on ear and sounds, it's ear consciousness. All the way down to body consciousness and mind consciousness. And then just as a fire is reckoned by the particular condition dependent on which it burns, when the fire burns dependent on logs, it's reckoned as a log fire. When it burns dependent on grass, reckoned as a grass fire, and so on. So too consciousness is reckoned by the particular condition dependent on which it arises. And then the footnote. Made this a little more clear when it said, the purpose of this simile about the fire is to show that there's no transmigration of consciousness across the sense doors. So it's like the five types of fire, like the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and so on. So just as a log, fire burns in dependence on logs and ceases when its fuel is finished, without transmigrating to a brush fire, which is kind of the point that Beata was making, that the fire doesn't actually move from one to the other. It's like a different fire. Now it's a brush fire, not a log fire. So thus the Buddha says, in effect, the occurrence of consciousness there is not even the transmigration from door to door, meaning like from eye, consciousness doesn't like transmigrate from the eye to the ear and so on. It's not like there's an internal consciousness that we have that when we're seeing, it moves into the eyes, and then when we hear, it moves out of the eyes and into the ears. We might think that mind consciousness is like that, but it doesn't even do that. So therefore, how can we even talk about transmigration from existence to existence? So it's just a little point about consciousness is just completely dependent on conditions and then ceases dependent on conditions, and it's completely impermanent each moment, and so on.
So this seems to imply, though, that a sense organ or a sense field is perceived independent of other senses. So he's just using this as a simile. He's not, I mean, is that the teaching? It's like eye consciousness is separate from ear consciousness, separate from taste consciousness.
They're different.
But they can co-arise together, right?
Yeah, or one sutra. Yeah. There's some debate within Abhidharma.
Your mouth waters, is that
what? Yeah, I think Abhidharma, there might be debate within it, but I think the most common view is that there actually aren't. But at the same time, you have one follows very closely, so it seems like you're tasting and smelling, but actually it's alternating.
And what about the fact that if you can't smell because you're stuffed up, you can't taste?
Yeah, so they're dependent.
They're dependent.
They dependently arise. That's one of the ways they're interdependent, the senses. And it also said that mental consciousness, the sixth consciousness, is kind of unique in that they say, because that's what conceptualizes things. So in order to have a concept of a taste, you need to have those. And at least in this Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra, this Mahayana Sutra talking about consciousness, it says, the mental consciousness, the sixth consciousness, called the mental consciousness, operates at the same time with the same object as a sense consciousness. Which would mean like you have a direct visual perception, like in the form realm, it's just color. But in order to actually like call it a book, you need the mental consciousness, and that is at the same time. There's not different, the sense consciousnesses are alternating different times, but the mental consciousness same time and same object. It can be that way, and you can have, can you have it without a mental consciousness? I don't know, that's getting too detailed now. But then, you know, this doesn't really, he never really explains, you know, this mechanism of rebirth. I don't think in any of these sutras, he never brings up the billiard ball and the candle flame. These are like later people trying to do something. And I think it's maybe in the spirit of people like Nagarjuna and so on. If we give any kind of like metaphor, anything, it's going to make it a graspable thing, and we're going to somehow turn it into there's something moving along through here, some permanent moving thing. So he just says, he just negates the view that there is something like that, and then teaches there's just dependent co-arising, which is kind of what Nagarjuna is doing too, is so that we don't negate everything. There's just dependent co-arising, very mysterious and hard to grasp what dependent co-arising actually is. And then he's talking about birth actually depends on three things. Later in the same sutra, the conception of an embryo in a womb takes place through three things. And this is, you know, pre-modern science, but kind of works here, I think. The three are the union of the mother and father, that moment, and then the mother's season, meaning like she's fertile at that moment, and then the being to be reborn is present. And so, wait a second, the being to be reborn? But you could say you know, a previous moment of consciousness in another body. Another body just ceased, and now you need these three things to all come together at the same time. According to, and then there's all kinds of later views about the bardo, right? This disembodied consciousness. And in fact, the being to be reborn, the footnote says, is a Gandharva, which is part of Buddha's cosmology of these like kind of like in-between beings, in-between birth beings. But if we don't even want to get into that, maybe a simple way to talk about it is just the moment one consciousness ceases in one body, that cessation is a condition for the arising of a new moment of consciousness. But there's no body here, but the consciousness has to give rise to something. So there's just a leap to some other body somewhere else. And that starts to sound pretty metaphysical and weird. So let's stop. But maybe possible. Maybe possible. So dependent co-arising. Now, Dogen also brings up the view of Seneca. Shrenika in the Bendoa. So you might remember this if you were in this class last fall in question number 10 of the question and answer part. So this is just another view, and actually this is somebody questioning Dogen, and he says, one master said, and I think he's talking about a Zen master. So this is a view that somebody's gonna ask about this view. This Zen teacher says, do not grieve over birth and death. There is an immediate way to be free from birth and death, namely to know the principle that the nature of mind is permanent. Nature of mind, you know, I would even question this some because there are teachings about the nature of mind being as is emptiness. There's mind, and then there's the nature of mind. So if we take it in that way, nature of mind, and there's some Indian teachings that bring that up, and the nature of phenomena versus phenomena, if we're using it in that way, this might actually hold up. But it looks like Dogen's interpreting as, you know, a true essence of mind. Maybe we could translate it as essence of mind. The immediate way to be free from birth and death is to know that there's an essence of mind that's permanent. It means that because this body is already in birth, it is brought to death, but the mind essence will not perish. you should recognize that you have in your body the mind essence, which is not affected by birth and death. This is the inherent nature. The body's a temporary form. It dies here and is born there and is not fixed. But mind is permanent. It does not change through past, future, and present. To understand this is to be free from birth and death. Those who recognize this principle end birth and death forever. So when your body ends, you enter into the ocean of essence. When you flow into the ocean of essence or nature, you attain wondrous virtue just as all Buddhas. And so on. Those who do not recognize this principle will go around in birth and death forever. And then the person asking this, after quoting this long piece, says, does such a statement as this accord with the path of all Buddhas and ancestors? And Dogen says, the view you have mentioned is not at all the Buddhist teaching, but rather the view of the heretic Seneca. So I think these are the two places that in Dogen's writings that he brings up Seneca. And Seneca said, there's a soul in the body, and the soul, on encountering conditions, recognizes good and bad, right and wrong. However, when the body is destroyed, the soul comes out and is born in another world. So on. Similar. And to take up the wrong view that mind is permanent and forms perish, and regard this as the inconceivable teaching of all Buddhas, is this not foolish? I cannot refrain from being sympathetic. Let me rescue you from your wrong view. How kind. You should know that in Buddha Dharma, it's always being said that body and mind are not separate. So this point, body and mind are not separate. Nature and characteristics are not two. We could even say true nature and characteristics, or form and emptiness, are not two. This was known both in India and China, so there's no room for mistake. In fact, the teaching about permanence says that all things are permanent without dividing body and mind. The teaching about cessation says that all things cease without separating nature and characteristics. How can you say body perishes but mind is permanent? Not only that, you should understand that birth and death is itself nirvana. So then he's bringing up this whole point about the way to escape from birth and death is to understand that there's this soul that goes through. So then he's going to bring up this whole other point about the way to actually escape or be free from birth and death, is samsara, is to see that it actually is nirvana. It's not separate. And that's a huge other topic, but not totally unrelated, but maybe briefly we could just say birth and death, the cycle of samsara, is dependent co-arising. That's what it is. Just lives are arising and ceasing according to conditions, dependent on all kinds of other things like air and food and water and disease and accidents and, you know, arising and ceasing, dependent on conditions. Nobody's in control of the process. All the beings within this interdependent process are also interdependent with each other, and the whole thing is inconceivably happening. And to understand that there is just that, the appearance of arising and ceasing, dependent on conditions, with no underlying essence or self-nature to the whole process within any one person or any kind of universal essence or soul behind it all either, is like the realization of nirvana. There's freedom right in the middle of this cycle, even when there's suffering, but it's so painful. But the deepest aspect of the pain even is that it's actually there's no underlying essence to the pain and the suffering, which would be like nirvana completely pervading samsara, like can't be broken apart. So to think that birth and death, samsara, has to be rejected is the mistake of ignoring Buddha Dharma. all things and all phenomena are just one mind. Nothing is excluded or unrelated. So we have these one mind teachings that we'll probably get into at some point because they're common in Zen. All Buddhas and all sentient beings are just one mind. But is this the universal soul, this one mind? What is this one mind? Maybe just one little piece about Seneca. So yesterday we got into Seneca's other name is Vajragota, supposedly, according to Nagarjuna. So, but there are mainly two that I discovered, Mahayana sutras that bring up Seneca. This is the advantage of the modern digital age, because we have the entire Chinese Tripitaka in digital form. This would be like 10,000 sutras and commentaries and Zen teachings and so on in the Buddhist canon in Chinese. So you can just plug in the characters for Seneca and search the whole canon, and in 5 seconds it will tell you every sutra that Seneca appears in. Very cool, yeah. Before, you know, in the old days it would be like this library, right, with like 10,000 books, like, whoa, Seneca, just tell me where you are. So it seems like he mainly appears in the Prajnaparamita sutras. So both in the, and we have an English translation, the large sutra on the perfection of wisdom, and the 8,000 line perfection of wisdom, Sreneca appears in there, and also the Maha Parinirvana Sutra, the Mahayana version of the long Parinirvana Sutra. So here's one where about Sreneca. It's actually a chapter called Sreneca, the Wanderer, in the long Prajnaparamita. And I think it's referring to this sutra we brought up yesterday about the 10 questions not to ask. And basically, Sreneca finally came around, and Vajragota finally came around to agree with the Buddha when the Buddha pointed out actually the 5 skandhas arising and ceasing with no independent self. If you remember that from yesterday, he finally, oh, okay, I got it. And like, he was asking all these questions about is the soul the same as the body, and is the soul reborn after death, and so on. And the Buddha kept saying, these questions are not pertinent. These questions don't are not reasonable. And he kept, why, just please answer them. And he, you know, finally the Buddha said, it's like this. There's just these arising and ceasing 5 skandhas of body and mind. And he finally saw it a little differently. And then said, I'd like to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha for the rest of my life. And so then, it may be that sutra, or maybe some related one, where the Prajnaparamita is saying, it says a lot of great stuff, just about, you know, it's basically emptiness teachings, but it's here about signs, the knowledge of all modes, or the, you know, the wisdom of understanding everything should not be grasped through a sign. Perfect wisdom, Prajnaparamita, cannot be held onto through a sign. A sign is like some, you know, way that we know something, some aspect of something in order to get a hold of it. Like there's signs of a book here, and then the mind grasps the signs of a book. It doesn't actually grasp the book, it grasps the signs of a book. It's just a way of talking about how we actually, what is grasping things, it actually is grasping the signs of things. So what, again, is a sign? Or what is sign? Form, and feeling, perception, formation, consciousness are signs. And they're called defilement because they're just merely signs. If, again, perfect wisdom could be seized through a sign, then Sreneca the Wanderer would not have gained faith in this Dharma And in the cognition of the faith here means the believing in perfect wisdom, the trusting confidence, the resoluteness, the deliberation, the weighing up, the testing, and that in the absence of any sign. So Kathy yesterday was asking about faith, I think. So so he entered this realization of faith through the absence of any sign. Perfect wisdom should be taken up through the signless. When Shrenika had faith in that cognition, he entered as a faith follower on this cognition. And having entered on it, he did not take hold of form or any other skanda. And why? Since all dharmas are empty of their own marks, there was no dharma which he could take hold of on account of his non-attention to a sign. So, if it is referring to that earlier sutra, I think it fits quite well that he understood that the five skandhas have no signs in which to grasp, and therefore gain this faith and confidence in the teaching that there's no five skandhas to grasp, and that there's no underlying spiritual intelligence or soul or anything that's separate from the body that lasts after death and these kinds of things, and thus was set free. Anything else you'd like to bring up this morning in regards to Seneca, the views, dependent co-arising, rebirth, karma, eternal soul, and emptiness?
Just be careful what you say, because 2,500 years later, I may get talked about in this room.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Seneca.
Yeah. It's easy to, like, say it a little bit off, right? Yeah. We say in the ordination ceremony, I think right at the very beginning of the, in the text, it says something like, as the person sits down and gets ready for the ceremony, the teacher says something like, tell me if it sounds familiar in Santa Cruz, something like, the good people, the source of mind is still. Can we say that? Something like that in the text. Good people, the source of mind is still. Or those who realize this are set free on the spot. So there's a meditation instruction for the next period. This very mind is still. May all beings enter the truth of this mind itself is Buddha. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. The illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.